This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscawen. Thanks for joining us today. Baseball inspires a lot of obsession. It's a game of statistics where fans mull over wonky things like batting averages, on-base percentages, and earned run averages. But there are other ways that some fans express their baseball passion. Zach Hample made his fandom known by catching as many home runs, foul balls, and even batting practice flies at different Major League Baseball stadiums. He's even made it into a business as a ball-catching coach. When he joined us in 2011, he had grabbed some 5,000 balls, and the number has grown to more than 8,000 today. He's the author of three books on baseball, including How to Snag Major League Baseballs. Let's listen. When I was writing up the introduction to the show, and I ended up saying Zach Hample has an obsession with baseballs, I began with Zach Hample loves baseballs, but I changed it to obsession. Should I change it back to love?
You could change it to sickness if you want. Yeah, it's all of the above. I don't know. I think my hobby has taken on different forms over the years. There was a time back in 1996 after I snagged my 1,000th ball and I was getting ready to go off to college. Yeah. I thought I was done with it. And I picked a school in North Carolina, Guilford College in Greensboro, that was, I think, 5 hours from the closest major league city, Atlanta, just because I wanted to get away from it. There were girls and there was college life to be lived, and I really didn't think that I was going to continue doing this much longer. But then I ended up writing a book about it after my freshman year, How to Snag Major League Baseballs, and that just kind of rejuvenated my passion for it and kind of got a lot of attention, I think maybe even more than it should have. It's kind of a media-friendly hobby, and that really got me back into it.
So a career was born out of an obsession, I guess?
Yeah, you could definitely say that.
Now, you did play ball, right? You played baseball in high school and a little bit in college as well. Did I read that right?
Yeah, I played baseball ever since I could stand on 2 feet. And my dream would have been, and it still is really, to be out there on the field with those guys. And sometimes I feel like I'm good enough. But, this is a good second place, I guess, to be in the stands catching baseballs, feeling like I'm somewhat of a participant, even though I'm, a little bit removed from the game, and writing about it and going to games with people and really making my living through baseball. So I can't really complain.
And how many fly balls have you caught during a baseball game? Do you know?
Well, I've gotten 155 baseballs directly off the bat during games. So that breaks down to, let me see. I'm geeky, but not geeky enough to have all of my stats totally memorized. But this is a big one. So let me see. 138 foul balls.
Okay.
16 home runs and one ground rule double.
And you have scoped out a lot of these stadiums to try to find the right place to be when a ball is actually hit by a batter, yes?
Yeah, I think one thing about catching baseballs at games that a lot of people don't realize is that the stadium itself, sort of the architectural layout, determines an awful lot about how easy it is to catch baseballs. Then you have to look at the size of the crowd, and then you have to look at security and how they run the place and how strict they are. You know, when I go to Citi Field, if I have a seat behind the dugout and I want to move to a worse seat in the outfield to try to catch a home run, they actually won't let me do that.
Oh,
they're
wow.
really strict there. Same with Yankee Stadium. You have to go to your ticketed section, even if you're trying to move to a worse section. At most stadiums, you can move around a little bit, just in the same way that people jaywalk and you're not really supposed to, but everybody does it and you're not really going to get in trouble. The same rules kind of apply at major league stadiums. Yeah, you're supposed to go to your seat, but I think it's just kind of a tradition that you kind of move around a little bit. You move down a few rows or you if seats free up a bit.
And how does Philadelphia stack up?
I like the layout of the stadium quite a bit. There's a lot of outfield seating. The biggest problem with Philadelphia, which of course is not a problem for most people, most normal baseball fans, is that the team is too damn good. So they sell out every game. And they
no
pack
empty
it in.
Seats there's, there, right?
Exactly. There's 45,000 fans per game. And that doesn't really make it easy to move around, move to an empty seat. So you have these huge outfield sections that extend all the way from the foul poles pretty much out to left and right center field. So most home runs that are hit are catchable, at least in terms of landing in seating areas. But it's so crowded. And then another problem is that there's no cross aisle or standing room section within the seats, really. I mean, you can stand behind the bullpens in deep right center field, but, you know, Superman on steroids probably won't hit a ball there. So it's tough to run back and forth, left and right. And that's really the key to catching baseballs, is to have some lateral range. Because the odds of a ball coming right to you are very slim. And even if it does, if you're packed in the middle of a long row of fans, who's to say that, you know, some 7-foot guy standing in front of you won't jump up and catch it? You know, so you have to be able to get up and move. So sit on the end of a row if you can. And again, if you're at a stadium that's not packed and you have seat 5, well, maybe seats 1 through 4 are empty and you shuffle over, or maybe the row in front of you has an end seat and you're not going to get yelled at if you move a couple seats here and there. And better yet, you know, you want to position yourself on an aisle or in a totally empty row or in a standing room only section, like Camden Yards in Baltimore, for example, has a huge standing room only section down the right field line. It's called the flag court. And anybody can hang out there at any time all day, no matter if you have the worst seat in the stadium, you can go and hang out there. And there's a lot of room to run around. So, you know, it's very easy for me to catch home runs during games in Baltimore. I mean, the players still have to hit them, of course. And it's very hard in Philadelphia. And it's really just a matter of the ballpark.
Well, and I would think, obviously, you see players running around catching a ball, that it might be easier to catch a ball on the field than it would be in a stand.
It definitely is. And I think that's another thing that most people don't realize. If you watch a major league outfielder, I mean, it's easy to keep your eye on the ball when it goes up in the air. But just as an experiment, next time you're at a game, and again, it's hard to do this on TV because the cameras only show you what they want to show you. Watch the outfielder, not the ball, as a high fly ball is floating down towards him, or any fly ball. You'll see that they don't pick out the exact spot. They drift with the ball right up until the last second. And in a lot of cases, if you watch the outfielder from the moment the ball's hit, you'll see that they sometimes move in the wrong direction. They'll take a quick step back, thinking that it's going to go over their head because the batter takes a ferocious swing, only to then have to run in and make a running catch, you know, or vice versa. And when you're in the seats and you have other fans, you have chairs, you have railings, all kinds of obstacles, you don't have the luxury of just drifting with the ball. So it's really tough, and you kind of have to either be very lucky or be very skilled at judging a ball and picking out the exact spot where it's going to land.
You're what is called a ball hawk, and you're not alone in this. Is there a kind of etiquette to ball hawking?
Well, definitely. There's a misconception that if I've caught 5,300 baseballs, then I must have knocked down 5,300 kids. But nothing could be further from the truth. I've been to more than 900 games in my life, and I've never knocked down anybody, young or old. I don't steal baseballs from people. I give baseballs to people. I help people catch balls. And, you know, there are jerks in all walks of life. So, yeah, there are some guys that do this that are definitely too aggressive. But I actually find that it's the people who've never caught a ball that you have to watch out for, because for them, they really do see it as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and they really might do whatever it takes to get that ball. People who go to a lot of games and catch balls, we just kind of know what we're doing out there, and you know, we're very careful of other fans. You know, just smaller etiquette rules, you know, when to reach in front of someone and when not to. For example, if a ball is thrown to someone, well, it's pretty clearly intended for that person, so don't reach in front of them to get it. But if it's a home run, well, I don't think any fan can claim ownership of the ball while it's in midair. So, you know, if you want to jump or reach for a ball, even if it's heading towards someone else, you can do that. But then again, if that someone else is a kid, catch the ball and hand it to them. So, you know, there are ways to do this and still be very nice about it.
It's interesting you say that, because something happened about 20 years ago with my son when I was at a Phillies game, and a man, unnamed, literally took a ball out of his hands and gave it to his daughter. And I am still steamed about that. And it literally was about 20 years ago. Now, I don't know if he was a ball hawk or just a dad that wanted to give his daughter a baseball, but he did take it out of my son's hands. And I'm still and I'm still mad at him.
I don't blame you. Yeah, I've witnessed a lot of this stuff at games over the years. And, you know, I prefer to give baseballs to little kids with gloves who are trying hard on their own to get baseballs and maybe just coming up a bit short. But when I see a kid get robbed like that, you know, I'll definitely reach into my bag and pull out a ball and give one to that kid. So, oh. I don't know. I don't
Where
like to see.
Where were you 20 years ago, Zach Ample?
Well, 20 years ago, I had just barely caught my first ball 20 years ago and really didn't have any clue what I was doing, but wish I could have been there for you.
Zach, I know you've been asked this probably 1,000 times, but just
let's make it 1,001.
We'll do it 1,001 since we're all about numbers today. Tell us about your glove and the kind of glove that you use to snag baseballs.
Ah, yes. I do have a little trick up my sleeve that has come to be known simply as the glove trick.
Yes.
It's much harder to describe than it is to show, but if anybody out there just simply does a search for glove trick on Google, my blog entry about it is the first thing that pops up. Basically, the way it works, if there's a ball sitting below me, ideally, let's say if there's a gap between the outfield wall and the base of the stands, kind of like a little dead zone where a home run could clear the wall but fall short of the seats, in batting practice usually, I have a long piece of string tied to my glove. And I can actually lower that glove from the stands and pick up baseballs that are out of reach. Wow. Now, I rig the inside of the glove with a rubber band and a Sharpie, just a magic marker that kind of props the glove open. It's really hard to describe, so just do a search for it. But the point is that it's sort of like go-go gadget arms when I'm at the game sometimes.
And I appreciate that description. But this is obviously something you developed, evolved over time and over, I guess, hits and misses when it came to trying to grab these baseballs.
Absolutely. You know, I'm a native New Yorker. So when I was 13, 14, and going to a lot of games at Shea and the old Yankee Stadium, Yankee Stadium in particular, when I'd be hanging out in left and right field for batting practice, those outfield walls varied from, I think, 8 to 10 feet high. Mm. And there were so many baseballs that would just roll up onto the warning track and be sitting on the field 2 feet out from the wall, but, you know, 8 or 10 feet down below me. There were no players around. There were no security guards around. You know, this was the early 90s before the Yankees were a dynasty. There were very few people at those games. There'd be 12,000 people, you know, during the game on a weeknight, and there'd be a couple hundred maybe during batting practice. So after drooling over these baseballs for many months, I had to figure out a way to extend my reach and be able to get them. And after a little bit of trial and error, I came up with this trick and proudly called my parents into my bedroom and stood up on a chair, which I think had some wheels on the bottom, and they were freaked out that I was going to fall and break my head. But I showed them that I could pick up baseballs out of reach, and we all had a good laugh at it at the time. But it's actually
worked,
turned
right?
into a... What's that?
You said it has worked over the years.
Oh,
yes.
I have gotten hundreds of baseballs with that trick over the years, and, you know, people tell me, oh, you should patent it. And, you know, I mean, I wrote about it in now 2 different books, and I've blogged about it, and I'm happy to help educate the competition. You know, I always want to catch every ball, but I realize that I can't. And part of the fun of, you know, being that guy who's caught so many balls is being able to spread the knowledge and to help other people catch balls and really to connect to the sport.
That was my 2011 conversation with baseball fanatic and ball catcher Zach Hample, author of How to Snag Major League Baseballs. You're listening to the baseball edition of Radio Times in Review. When we get back from the break, we'll hear my conversation with former Philly Doug Glanville. Stay with us. Welcome back to the baseball edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Thanks again for joining us today. The life of a professional athlete requires putting performance and focus above all else. Doug Glanville spent his early life devoted to becoming a professional ball player, which he did, building a 15-year career at center field, some of those years with the Phillies. But as his tenure in the outfield was coming to an end, he fell out of love with professional sports and began writing a column for the New York Times, Heading Home. In it, he discussed the life lessons of the game, and he still writes pieces for the Times today. He joined us in 2010 after writing a book on the topic called The Game From Where I Stand, A Ballplayer's Inside View. Let's take a listen. You wrote about being a single guy in baseball, and we were talking about the pressure on couples, but the fact that you were a single guy, also kind of a nerdy high school kid, and the kind of, I guess, opportunities women that might not have looked at you in high school. The moment you become, you know, part of this professional sports, and you, something you did for about 15 years, you were, in a sense, as you said, getting the kind of girls that might have stressed you out as a younger man.
Right. No, there's no question. I mean, you have this high school self, and you know, you have to keep in mind that the major league world doesn't necessarily advance that, you know, from maturity, because you have to be a big kid to play major league baseball. So you're kind of stuck and you're stagnated in this space where you're, you know, the same kind of kid socially in a lot of ways.
And you get reinforced for that all the time. Right?
All the time. All the time. You're going out, you have the environment, and then you don't really have to develop it as much as you have this instant conversation starter. And when you get lazy in that world, it just sort of breeds onto itself. And I think a lot of players are like, oh, this is great. You know, this woman used to scare me to death in high school. Now all of a sudden I can call her. I have her phone number, you know. You know, so guys just lose their mind in that situation. And I think that's part of what hurts them in their relationships too, because you don't have to really cope as easily, which is very much connects to the whole steroid era, right? Mm-hmm. It's a lot to do with coping too. Like, wait a minute, I don't want to deal with slowing down. I don't want to deal with relationship stress. So I can just sort of take this little blue pill and get by. And that's sort of how I deal with it. And that just always compromises your ability to cope through situations. So if you're practicing these habits as a person in a relationship, certainly it's hard to sustain things when you actually go through difficult times.
So how do you stay centered? I mean, you were a single guy and you didn't use steroids, but nonetheless, there are all those quote unquote temptations.
Absolutely. Well, it's hard. You trip and fall quite a bit, or you know, just like anybody's going to start going through, and you have to figure out what's going on, or are these people around me genuine? So you make your choices and mistakes, and that's part of it. And then your ability to adjust off that is sort of internal. Are you going to say, okay, wait a minute, this isn't good for me? I mean, when I first made the major league roster for the Chicago Cubs, I would go out in Arizona with all my teammates in spring training, and we'd paint the city red and do whatever. And then I realized, wait a minute, my locker's next to Ryan Sandberg. You know, I'm trying to make the big leagues, and I can't do that being coming home at 3 a.m. But a large majority of players in the minor leagues don't necessarily make that decision to say, you know what, I'm not going to. This is like works counter to what I'm trying to achieve. So you have to be very goal oriented and focused and see that this is kind of distracting you from what you need to do. And as Joe Tanner, one of my former base running coaches, said, you know, it's hard for people to understand, but baseball, you actually have to give up the best years of your life. And it's sort of like, well, this is weird. What else would you be wanting to do at this time? But actually that it's resonated, because I said, wait, now that's true. You have to do that in a way, because it's all about the game. And these other relationships become so peripheral that it's hard to develop them in any meaningful way.
But do you think you had an advantage? You were a college graduate. You graduated from the University of Pennsylvania. A lot of these young players are just out of high school. They didn't get those couple of extra years in college or something beyond high school.
Yeah, and that's very difficult, because it's not just your talent and your abilities. Your socialization is at the same stage. So you're sitting there and you're going, well, wait a minute, there's all these other people in this environment. I got to learn how to deal with these persons. And in fairness to players, like you could be 16 years old and come in from the Dominican Republic and, you know, not finish high school, and you're taking care of family and brothers and sisters. It's a very difficult time, and you may not have the infrastructure to kind of help you deal with all these things.
But do you think there are also just so many enablers within the system, whether it's the players that look the other way, or the other people that are part of a team or part of a franchise, even the owners, the managers, that they're just people that enable it in that almost psychiatric sense?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that, oh yeah, you're the greatest, you do this, you're Tiger Woods, you're whoever you are. And if you get so caught up in defining yourself by the sort of image of everybody else, you will get into trouble. It just makes it a fragile relationship, because as soon as you're not playing or doing, you know, you're sort of someone else, you're not really an interest anymore. So those type of temporary relationships are weak foundations to sort of stay the course on something. And so, yeah, and then you have teammates, and there's a culture, and there's also a code. And, you know, like, it's almost like family. You can't, my brother may not do certain things I like, or vice versa, or whatever, but it's not like I'm going to go public domain about it and say, hey, you know, my brother. So you keep a lot of in things internally, and that sort of breeds itself, because you're like, oh, well, they're doing it and everybody else is doing it. And so that's the high school kind of element. It's sure. The peer pressure that you're only dealing with other people who are similarly situated. So they're not telling you anything different than what you're already going through.
And it seems to me the interesting thing related to Tiger Woods is, you know, how will he rehabilitate himself, I guess, both on and off the field when there's that kind of distraction and you've got a game like golf, probably a lot like baseball, where focus and concentration is so much an element of the game.
Right. And I'm very curious how he adjusts to that, because he's had this sort of robotic kind of image, right? He's like in the zone and I'm not distracted and, you know, he has that focus. So part of what makes him a great talent is also mm-hmm. part of what his weakness is. I always felt like your strengths, you know, can be your curses too. And, you know, so yes, if he's that exceptional, there's a lot of baggage with that, to stay on top all the time, every day, being Tiger Woods, winning tournaments, Masters, chasing Jack Nicklaus. You know, your focus can be such that, you know, even your wife and everybody close to you could be sort of accessories, so to speak, hmm. to your enterprise. And that usually starts a lot of problems.
Well, in fact, you say that fear is really one of the dominant emotions in trying to, I guess, make it as, in your case, a baseball player, or make it in professional sports, the kind of fear that surrounds your performance every day.
No, there's no question. I mean, you think about this life of your career. Mine was 8 years, eight and a half years in Major League Baseball. But every year you're fighting for your job. You're trying to figure out this. There's a young guy coming up. I mean, you're constantly under assault. I mean, they always say, well, you know how many people would want to give their left arm? Well, that's how many people are competing with you. So you have to stay on top and try to find edges and ways to do it. So that insecurity, you know, especially when you're getting older and things are changing, is a very powerful thing and makes, you know, people can do very rash things.
A couple of years ago when you were playing, you got two home runs off of Curt Schilling, yeah. former Philadelphia pitcher here. And you're quoted as saying, Curt's a friend of mine. He used to play video games. We used to play video games together. He killed one of my characters one time. I never forgot that. And you also wrote in a column about a year ago, you said, under no circumstances should you show up a baseball player. We hold grudges forever. We will find a way to throw it back in your face. It could take a week. It could take 25 years. In fact, just like any other debt, your heirs may have to pay if we don't get you while you're still alive. Still, we'll get you and your trustee. So revenge is a powerful feeling.
Well, in baseball, the code, you know, it's that code, and
it's all personal, right?
It's very personal. You know, one on one, me against you and the pitcher, and there's a lot of that that kind of spills over. But there's, you know, baseball has so many unwritten rules and etiquette, and you learn them sometimes the hard way. But, you know, you're flipping the bat, you're doing things that you're not supposed to, showing people up. They remember. And the beauty of baseball is you'll be out against you the next day, so you can get them.
Must have been a delightful day when you got two home runs off of Curt Schilling.
Yeah. You know, I thought the press was very, like, surprised at my reasoning tied to a video game character, but I had a lot of fun with that.
Were there certain things that you did specifically before a game? I know sometimes players have superstitious things that they do, or things they carry in their pocket just to help them be lucky that day.
Yeah, I wasn't hugely superstitious, but I still, you know, I liked, once I attached myself to something, I stuck with it. Like, I used the same kind of bat for like my whole career. I didn't change bats and same color. I had Cooperstown spikes that I wore that they were the same model. And then they tried to upgrade it to the modern era with Air This. I was like, no. Give me my old spike. So I liked the tried and true. And that was sort of my superstition, if anything.
And I guess that provided a kind of constancy, right? That you knew that the bat was going to feel a certain way, or the shoes were going to feel a certain way.
Yeah, and that's also psychologically important, because you're in a world of nomads and changing addresses, changing girlfriends, changing teams and hats and uniforms and coaches. So, you know, you have to find something that makes you feel like you're consistent and you're regular and you have some home. And that's part of the superstition, too. It's just sort of like your home within the game.
So do you remember when you, I guess, first picked up a baseball or picked up a baseball glove or a bat?
Well, I have to credit my brother on that one.
Is that right? You have an older brother, right?
Older brother. He's 7.5 years older. And so he couldn't wait for a playmate. So as soon as I could walk, he was like, here's a bat, here's a ball, let's go. And it's rain, shine, snow, whatever. So I credit my brother from that moment. And he kind of mapped out his projected career for me. And it worked out pretty well. So
yes.
I give him, he's a good coach. And he's still playing, actually. He's 47. And he's still running around and playing in multiple leagues. So really good athlete and a tremendous inspiration, because I was always chasing him, you know. So how do I catch my brother? And that was created a lot of competitive spirit in me.
But did he ever play professional baseball? Or
no, he didn't play. He went to a million tryouts. Back in the day, they used to have the scouting bureau. So you could go and kind of, you know, you get something in the mail and say, okay, there's one in Pittsfield, Massachusetts or wherever. And he would drive all over the place with friends and try to, you know, so he never signed on, but he's a great player and played many and still playing. And, you know, he kept all his stats. And you know, I mentioned one column, he stole his 1,000th career base or something. And there's some, you know, Sandlot league, and he got the third and put the base over his head. And people are like, what is this guy doing? Like, he's like, it's my 1,000th career base. So
he still loves the game.
Oh, he loves the game. I always call him the passion point of our family. He's just like, he's all heart. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he created such an environment for us, like, to celebrate just leaving it all on the table.
And yet, as you write about your career in baseball, is that you fell out of love. Maybe not with the game, but with professional baseball.
Well, I think it was a season. You know, there's a time for it, and I felt part of it is playing too. Like I, you know, from the time I could pick up a ball, I started. I played every day, and I don't care who you are, you don't like sitting on the bench. You know, and my career started to take a turn. I had an injury and tore a hamstring, and all these things started to happen. I certainly knew the steroid era was amongst us. And I was, you know, sort of disenchanted. And then I played a whole year in Philly in 04 where I was just on the bench most of the year. And it's hard, like, hard enough, but then you're pinch hitting against Randy Johnson. You're sort of like, okay, what's going on here? So it was tough, and I certainly didn't want to go back to the minor leagues. And it seemed like that became my only option at one point. And I said, you know, it's time to go home. Mm-hmm. And that's where my column title came from, Heading Home. Like, I'm going home now. And it's still hard. And as my friend said, it's like going through barbed wire to get to the other side. But it was time for me, and it took a little, you know, time to get everything else going. But now I'm in a wonderful place. I love writing, and I can write about what I love is baseball, and kind of found a new kind of love for the game, and it's been really rewarding.
And I know home is Chicago, and you're married, and you've got kids, and you've got another career. But when you left, what and where was home?
Well, once the music stopped, so to speak, I retired as a Philadelphia Philly. I signed this like one day exploding contract, and which took like 2 months to figure out because it's really complicated, actually. And it was like June 25th, I believe, in 05. And then I was in Philly for a while. And then we said, my wife and I were like, you know what? It's time to like spread our wings. And we both were kind of transitioning. And we said, well, you know people in Chicago. You have a real estate business you're working on. Let's see what we can do there. And so I think we're just looking for the change and just see what would happen. And we went through our lumps, but we kind of settled in nicely. And all of a sudden, since the game, I have two wonderful, beautiful kids. And it's that changes your inspiration in a lot of ways also.
And I should say to our listeners, a big smile when you mention your children.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We're talking about some of the psychology of the game, which you say is probably most of the game. But what's it like when you are – you know, either as a player in a streak where you can't hit the ball, or as a team, you're just down in the dumps and you have to go, you know, you have to go out and play a couple times a week and get yourself out of whatever that psychology is.
Yeah, the slump, you know.
The slump, exactly.
And you have all kinds of slumps. I mean, it could be hitting, but it could be a team-wide effect. And you usually go back to the fundamentals. You try to, like, get in the hitting cage, and you do what's comfortable, and you just try to find any way to have success. I played with Alex Rodriguez in 2003 in Texas. Now, this was probably the most talented player. You know, let's put the steroid side aside, but he was a very talented player. And he basically had no hits in June, 0 for 20-something or another, struggling. And you could see he was an out. And this is a, you know, talented player. And even, I guess, looking back, he was performance-enhanced at that. And I remember he finally got a hit against Tampa Bay. And he was like, basically he was looking to come out. He's like, I'm 1 for 3. Let me just kind of sit on this. It was that frustrating. But, you know, he was in the cage every day. He was in the gym. He did what he had to do to get ready. And a lot of people go through that. They try to, you go back to what's comfortable. And then eventually, if you have the opportunity, you'll find your hits and you'll find your rhythm again.
But you have to fight your own thoughts, you know, those negative thoughts that I would assume are, you know, they're in our heads. They're in everybody's heads. But if you're there in a slump, those negative thoughts are not going to help you.
No. Yeah. Well, you have to fight your own thoughts. You also have to fight everybody else's advice. You know?
Well, exactly.
It's like, you know, I know what you're doing. Your shoulder's coming out. And so everybody has an opinion. And it comes back to you knowing yourself better than anybody. You have to know, like, okay, I'll take this. I'll throw this out and find what it takes. I mean, it is part of the game. So if you have perspective and you have the opportunity that you're going to be the starter, you're good. Now, I lost my job for part of the 2002 season. But what was hard about that is I didn't have a chance to really get back in. So, yeah, everybody goes through slumps. If you pull out the greatest player on the planet when they're like 1 for their last 30, they're going to struggle too because they just have they're going to be their own worst enemy at a certain point. Like, wow, I'm not playing now. So a lot of people deal with that. And I think most guys that get out of it sort of have the perspective that it's a long season. They get back to some fundamentals and they find ways. And no matter who you are, you're going to deal with it and play long enough and you know that.
Well, and we are also in Philadelphia. So do the Philadelphia sports fans or baseball fans, is their reputation deserved?
Oh, hardcore. I mean, tough love. You know, I mean, someone made a great point. It was an idea that my editor had. He said, well, Philly is sort of tough love. And Chicago is sort of mother's love, or so, you know, he kind of had to, I said, that's interesting.
Is Chicago okay with that?
Well, I think they would probably look at it a little. Well, they're Cubs fans have changed a little bit since I played there. It's a lot of expectations, and they now like, hey, we've won, we've had a taste, so now like you can't come back with this 500 club. Philly was a place. The challenge of a player that embraces it is like they're unconquerable in a way. Like, you got to be good all – you got to be representing all the time. And that I kind of found inspiration in that in some ways, because I was like, you know what? I can't be complacent in Philadelphia. Like, that's and it's very hard to kind of be just, like, on autopilot in Philly. So I think that is something when you tap in a certain direction, you could be great about it. But it's a challenge because you're not going to just, you know, always get the benefit of the doubt. You have to – yeah, you had a good game yesterday, but guess what?
Yeah,
you
know? it starts all over again
right.
today,
and
right?
Run out, I remember in Devon White, like, he had, like, a bad hamstring. He was playing for the Diamondbacks, and he, like, you know, didn't run out of ball. And I knew he had a bum leg or something, and they were like, boo, boo. You know, because it's like, you better run hard. Like, we came out here hard-earned money to see someone hustle, and I don't care if you're on the other team or whatever, so – you know, so I was a Philadelphia fan and myself, so I understood that. You know, I loved the Phillies '80s and '70s and '80s. So it's a tough town, but you can obviously, as proven, you can win.
That was my 2010 interview with writer and former Philadelphia Philly Doug Glanville. When we get back from the break, we'll hear from another man familiar to Philly sports fans, Jamie Moyer. Stay with us. Welcome back to the baseball edition of Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We close out today's show on America's Pastime by listening to my conversation with former pitcher Jamie Moyer. He's a beloved figure in Philadelphia, having pitched for the Phillies during their 2008 championship season. He was 45 then, and 4 years later, he made history with the Colorado Rockies when he became the oldest pitcher to win a game. He joined us in 2013 along with Philadelphia journalist Larry Platt. The two had collaborated on a memoir, Just Tell Me I Can't, How Jamie Moyer Defied the Radar Gun and Defeated Time. It discussed Moyer's life in baseball and the perspective he gained from his various mentors and the mindset of the mound. Let's take a listen. So why did you want to write a book with Jamie Moyer, Larry?
It was basically the mystery of how does this guy do it? He was not only the oldest pitcher to win a game, but arguably the best old pitcher ever. You know, you look at Tom Seaver between the ages of 38 and 42. He was 66 and 64. Jamie Moyer was 74 and 33. Mm. You know, it is a singular accomplishment, especially for a guy who only threw 80 miles per hour. So how did he do it? And when we first started talking about it, I realized that it was because he figured out, as he says, that baseball takes place from the neck up. And so we want to delve into the mystery of the mental side of the game.
Well, and which got you to this guy named Harvey Dorfman.
Yes.
You this was in your late 20s, right?
It was in my late 20s. Right. I had read one of his books, The Mental Guide to Baseball or Mental Game of Baseball. And you know, I really kind of felt like I understood the book and I was going to take this information and run with it. And you know, I think as a little time elapsed, I realized that I didn't really completely understand it as well as I thought. And my agent at the time had the good fortune of turning me on to Harvey in the off season. And I went to go visit him in Prescott, Arizona, and spent 2.5 days with him. And really then came to realize that, well, I didn't realize this information as well as I read it, and the time spent with Harvey was very, very productive, I guess I could say. And actually, I think it was kind of the beginning of the end of, or not the end of my career, but kind of my second career.
In fact, you played better in your 40s than you did in your
20s. Yeah, right? Yeah. Most definitely. And, you know, I think maturity and age had something to do with that, but experience. Mm-hmm. And also some of the clubs I played on were, you know, you look at this Philadelphia team in the 2000s that I played on was a pretty special group of guys.
So what did he teach you? I mean, talking about the mental game of baseball.
Yeah, it taught me, you know, a lot about, you know, dedication. You know, there's a, we all, you know, each time you do something, there's a task at hand, you know, and to focus on that task. You know, he taught me that, you know, we all have fears in life. And we all, and a lot of times we have anxiety towards that fear, and it's a negative anxiety, or it takes you down a horrible path because of the fears that you have. Well, you know, let's take that energy that we're wasting and using on those fears and try to figure out a way to get through that and turn it into a positive. And all of a sudden that fear, all of a sudden, isn't as big.
Well, it seemed like he also was saying to you that your lack of speed, if I can say
that,
was a weapon.
Exactly.
It wasn't a weakness
and,
for you.
Exactly. And taking that and becoming aggressive, using aggression with that, but a controlled aggression. And all that comes from you know, learning about yourself. And learning what you have, you know, for baseball, we can call it tools or weapons. You know, you can say a baseball is a weapon, but it's using the tool from your shoulders up and how to start to categorize things and what is important and what's not important. And learning that what other people think or say it maybe isn't the most important thing, but what how you feel and what you think and how you're working towards that goal or that direction, that's what's really important. And if you do it well, what those people think and say is going to be really good.
Well, and what's interesting about Harvey, and there are many things interesting about Harvey Dorfman, it seems like he, Larry, knew fear himself. He wasn't a player. He was a sickly kid.
Right.
So he knew something about fear.
He battled fear. He was asthmatic from birth and grew up in the Bronx. And, I mean, fascinating parallels between these two lives as I did my research. His father, like Jamie's father, was a mentor who used baseball to teach life lessons. And Harvey knew fear, and he had developed – he wasn't a trained psychiatrist or psychologist. He developed his own – long before a lot of people have come to this, he developed his own regimen for overcoming fear and gaining success.
And when you went to him, what were you afraid of?
Some of it was failure. Or, you know, getting released or not having a job. Because baseball was something, as a little boy, I wanted to do. Just like many other little boys, you know, have that dream. But, you know, I just, you know, as I became a young man, I still believed that. And, you know, and why wouldn't I? Because I had a lot of success. And I was doing something that I enjoyed doing. But as I got to the professional level, obviously I was now playing with and against guys that were as good. And in most cases had way more talent than I had. And I, you know, then started to learn that, yeah, talent will get you only so far. But, you know, what you, how you use that talent and how you use the talent of, you know, your brain. And that what was really kind of fascinating as things started to evolve for me. And then it became intriguing. And the more I get into it, the more I wanted to work with it. And realize that it's some very simple changes that I had to make, but I had to have an awareness towards those changes.
Was it also changing the conversation you might be having with yourself?
Most definitely.
And I think anyone that is feeling like they're not working up to their speed, then you begin to beat yourself up.
Exactly. And it's the negativity. And when you're saying that conversation, it's usually a negative conversation, and a lot of times that's based off of negative results. Or the negative results are based off of the conversation that you're having with yourself because you're not allowing yourself to put yourself into a positive situation and have positive thoughts. And usually when we have negative outcomes, then if you look back at things, there's negative thoughts that go with that. And that's where, you know, and I can look back at my career and look at teams that I've been on and you look at the negative outcome as a team. It was a huge reflection on how we were as a group.
Interesting.
And the negativity. And then you look at the teams that won, you look at the positive side and the way they approach things. So you can see how that can really play a huge role you know, on an individual basis, but as a team and even as a fan base. Really?
Hey, you're here in Philadelphia. But were you playing with the sort of head of the batter as well? I mean, the idea is that, I mean.
Oh, yeah. And that's, you know, again, you know, the direction, you know, one of the directions that Harvey taught me was that, you know, we all have an ego. And if you can learn how to play off of people's egos and use their egos against them. And, you know, I kind of liken it to, you know, the bigger the guy, the stronger the guy, the bigger the swing, the harder the swing. That played into what I was as a pitcher, because I was more of an off-speed type of a pitcher. I relied on deception. So I wanted to show you what a fastball looked like, but maybe it wasn't in the strike zone. But now I'm tempting you with that pitch, and now I'm going to throw you something slow that might be in the strike zone and looks like a fastball, and I want you to react to it like a fastball, but it just never got to the plate.
But are we talking about humiliation, Larry, here, humiliating the batter?
It is no accident that he flourished in his 40s, which was the same time as the steroid era. So you had all these players who were all jacked up, who come up to that plate, and they're going to take this cream puff pitcher deep. And he just sent them back on their way to the dugout because he used that. And he would pick up signs from them. He calls it listening to the at-bat, pick up signs from them in the at-bat. And he'd say, like, to himself, that internal dialogue, he'd say, now I've got him, because the guy's, if he's slow to get around on that outside pitch, now I've got him inside. Mm-hmm. He calls it the cat and mouse game, and it's poker. It's poker,
and it's fun, I guess. Right?
It is.
I mean, especially if things are going well.
It's challenging because you're always feel like you have to be one step ahead, but it's all right in front of you, and if you're just receptive to it, you use your eyes and use your ears. Because sometimes verbally, some things are said verbally, you can hear it. Mm-hmm. And if you're watching body language, or if you're watching a swing, or the body language after a swing, or if the guy makes an out, how he acts or reacts, or then you watch him go out on the field. And now all of a sudden you've turned his day into a bad day. He's really, the way I look at it, he's turned his own day into a bad day. I just happen to be the conduit to help him do that.
Larry, you say there's really two Jamie Moyers, and one is the gentleman and one is the warrior.
That's right. He is renowned throughout baseball as a class act. Media goes to him after the game. He always has time for people. He's won the Branch Rickey Award, the Roberto Clemente Award as a humanitarian of the game. But on the mound, like his mentor, Harvey Dorfman, he could be an SOB. And I mean that with affection and respect. Harvey said to him in that first meeting to consider the mound your effing circle. And that has been his clarion call. When we talked earlier about aggression, Harvey got him to see that he had to pitch inside. Mm. And after that first session with Harvey, Jamie wrote in one of these notebooks, knock someone down. He's a very old school, very polite, very, as you can tell, very articulate, nice guy. On the mound, he's mean.
Well, something that you would ask batter sometimes, which is, what do you want?
Yeah.
Which seems so counterintuitive.
Yeah. Right. Well, at time, or even pregame, if I would, going over a scouting report with a catcher, and I'd say, this guy owns me. You know, I knew who hit me well and who didn't hit me, and it's in the back of the book. There's some guys that, both ways. And I'd say, you know what? We'd go over a scouting report, and I might be a little frustrated. And he'd say, well, I think we should do this. I'm like, you know what? That guy's beat me on that pitch so many times. I'd look at the catcher and say, look, why don't you just tell him what's coming today? And the guy would look at me like, are you kidding me? We can't do that. But really, it's because I'm trying to right. play with your psyche right. and try to get you out of kilter a little bit. And if I can regain that edge or get the upper hand on you, now you're going to become frustrated and you're going to start playing outside of your own boundaries and getting in your own way. And that's exactly what I want you to do.
Because the batter would be saying, why are you asking me this question?
Exactly. And usually they're pretty locked in, or term we use locked in or focused. So if I could get you out of focus and get you thinking or laughing or, get you relaxed, and all of a sudden I get a ball by you and you go, oh, you got me. You know, that's not going to happen again. So now all of a sudden they think about that at bat, you know, especially when they weren't successful, till they come up again, and now all of a sudden that here's where that cat and mouse game goes.
Jamie Morris, I was reading this book. It was like oldest.
Right.
Do you like that?
You know what? You learn to like it because, you know, when I first started to hear it, it was like, really? I'm not that old. But in baseball terms, I was. But in life, in the game of life, you know, I really wasn't. But everybody started to use it because it was easy to use. Hey, old man, you know, and, you know, stuff in the newspaper, on TV, you know, wherever it was. So, you know what? I just learned to like it. And actually had a lot of fun with it. And my teammates, once they got to know me, you know, the Jimmy Rollins, the Chase Utleys, those guys, Shane Victorinos, they really liked to use it on me. So, but it was fun because I could always, you know, if I got a little tired, I'd say, hey, boys, remember, you need to respect your elders.
And that does work, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
I guess occasionally.
Yep.
What did you learn? And in many ways, as I was reading this book and some of the things that Dorfman was teaching could be applied to a lot of life.
Absolutely. What I learned a ton. When Jamie and I first met, I had just had shoulder surgery. We're basically the same age. There was a moment when we were just before he went to spring training. It's a short scene in the book. We're driving down, ironically enough, the Ted Williams Highway in San Diego, and a car is passing us with, I don't know, an 80-year-old woman who's blaring Holiday, the song by Madonna, and singing. And Jamie Moyer sees that in his rearview mirror, says, check this out. He rolls his windows down. He honks. He calls to her. They both are driving on the highway together, singing together. And I thought, this is what the book is about. It's actually how to age. It's actually how to be youthful and vibrant. He is an object lesson.
It is interesting to think about Phillies fans, notorious for their outspokenness, shall we say.
Notorious for their outspokenness, but also notorious for their passion. And I think they recognized in Jamie, first of all, when they won the World Series and he made that speech and he said, you know, in 1980, I sat where you sat. He grew up a Phillies fan idolizing Steve Carlton. So that's part of the affection that this town has for someone like him.
In fact, didn't you play hooky that day, or you got out of school
day
so you could come down?
I can now say it. I did play hooky.
couldn't have gotten away with that if you had somehow admitted it
right, in
high school.
Right, exactly.
And what explains your longevity? I mean, is it just your style of pitching?
There's a lot. Again, it's a combination of many things. It starts with health, you know, good genes. You know, I've been blessed by my parents to have good genes. Work ethic. I really probably didn't have my first surgery in my career till I was in my mid to late 40s.
Wow.
So I was very fortunate that way. I've been, you know, I was pretty healthy throughout my career. Good people around me. I learned, you know, I really felt like I had to be a sponge because I didn't feel like when I came into this game, I had, you know, unbelievable talent. I just felt like I had talent and I was good at what I did, you know, and hence just tell me I can't, because that's really what I was told my whole life. You're too small. You don't throw hard enough. I was always told the things that I couldn't do, but from my side of it, my perspective, I always had success. So why am I going to let these people deter me from a dream of mine?
That was my 2013 conversation with baseball veteran Jamie Moyer and Philadelphia journalist Larry Platt about the book Just Tell Me I Can't, How Jamie Moyer Defied the Radar Gun and Defeated Time. And that wraps up the baseball edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thanks for joining us, and go Phils!